Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Wow. It's my pleasure to be here. I've had a great day, and in fact, I met one of my lab mates from back in grad school. but it's definitely a small world. Well, what you may notice from the title of the talk is that it may not sound like physics, and indeed, what we've been doing, and I'm a material scientist, okay, so there's going to be a lot of materials in this work that you're going to see, but what we've been doing might seem more like alchemy, but it's really led by the physicists. So if I was to, you know, add an air of witchcraft to the alchemy here, I would start by introducing really the stars of the show. And these people, these three people, made a change in my life about a decade ago, and I'll tell you how in the next 50 minutes how these people changed my life. These are all theorists, theorists that make predictions about materials. And I want to say what I mean by a prediction. A prediction is not explaining what's already known. A prediction is somebody that's bold and says, if you put the atoms together in this way, you will have this new desirable property. And I'm going to show you examples from these people's work. Craig Feeney here and I started the same day at Cornell. So he was a student of Karen Rabe. Maybe you know Karen. Hopefully these are familiar people to you. Long Chen was my former colleague at Penn State. They do different kinds of theory. Karen and Craig do first principles theory, prediction, particularly on dielectrics, ferroelectrics, multiferroics. Long Chen does continuum theory. And I'll be showing examples of both in the talk. Now, in the talk, I'm going to talk about oxides, and particularly how to take what you might think of as a boring, dull oxide, maybe it's just a regular old textbook insulator, and turn it into something exciting. So something where, in the absence of an electric field, it has a polarization. Okay, we call this a ferroelectric. And by applying an electric field, you can move that polarization from one direction to another. Or a material that's exciting, instead of being paramagnetic, suddenly it becomes magnetically ordered, and you can use a magnetic field to flip the magnetization from one direction to the other. Or a material that's both at the same time. And I'm going to show you examples of all three of those in this talk, where we start with some totally boring, if you will, normal textbook insulator, and turn it into a material that has this desirable property. And this work is all on the shoulders of prediction. So there are some, you know, sets of materials where theory works really well, and other materials that it doesn't work so well for. You know, maybe high-temperature superconductivity is one of those. But I'm going to show you things where it works really well for, and that's in these ferroelectric and multiferroic systems. And the trick is that you have multiple competing ground states that are close to each other in energy, and by tweaking the material in some way, and the tweak that I'm going to talk about is the strain tweak. So we're going to strain the material, and it's going to go from one ground state, which I'll call boring, to a more interesting, more useful ground state. And these predictions, in terms of what's new, they go back even more than a decade to where theorists, this is phenomenological theory, so thermodynamic analysis, this is first principles analysis, but basically what the effect of biaxial strain should be on a film of a boring dielectric. So, and if you look at the theory, there's some very unusual things that this material, which is normally a boring dielectric, it's not ferroelectric at any temperature. This prediction is that if you strain it, you can make it not only become exciting and ferroelectric, but make it ferroelectric at room temperature. So that's once I learned how to read the diagram, that was a big part. You know, is first reading the diagram, and seeing what it meant, and then seeing if it was true or not. Here's another prediction. This is Craig Feeney and Karen Rabe's work, that you take this boring dielectric, so it's normally paraelectric and anti-ferromagnetic, okay, in its ground state, basically useless. Okay, and I'll show you the prediction is that you should be able to turn on magnetism in this material by applying an electric field. Okay, so I'm not talking about a solenoid. Okay, I'm talking about an insulator to which you hook it up to the battery, and suddenly it becomes a very strong ferromagnet with 7 Bohr magnetons per unit cell. OK, Okay, so a huge ferromagnet. Okay, similar things. Now these things, you know, got my attention. Here's a more recent prediction of the effect of strain. Maybe you're thinking of saving the world by inventing some new photocatalyst, like it's going to do water splitting from sunlight. That the effects of strain on the band gap and the band lineup are also being predicted by first principles. And these are all, you know, things where theory is indeed leading the way. And I'll show you where experiment stands. Now, the idea of imparting strain on materials is very old. Okay. We're certainly not the first group to do it. Even when you get to oxides, it's very old. So this is an old work. It's the oldest work I could find. This is work from MIT in the 50s, where they took barium titanate single crystal. So this is a ferroelectric. It's one of the model systems in ferroelectrics, barium titanate, discovered during the war independently by all the three major powers. Very important in terms of making small capacitors. But this material, barium titanate, take a single crystal of it, make this rig that puts pressure on it, so there's oil out here in this reservoir, increase the pressure, the barium titanate gets squeezed biaxially, okay? So it's squeezed from the edges. And what this was reported in this work is that the transition temperature of this ferroelectric goes from, this is in C, okay, goes from being about 108 to about, goes up by about 100, about 10 degrees, and then the crystal breaks, okay? Now that's an example of what I'm talking about. The difference in what I'm going to talk about in this talk compared to this bulk work is that I'm going to talk about straining thin films. So oxides, most of them are very brittle materials. And a big difference when you're straining a film versus a bulk is the thickness of it. And you can strain a film a lot more, 10 times more. This breaks at about a tenth of a percent strain. I'm going to show you things that strain by more than a percent. And indeed, if you strain this thing 10 times more or 30 times more, like I'm going to show you in this talk, instead of getting a shift that's 10 degrees, you can get a shift that's hundreds of degrees. And you can take a material that's normally not, doesn't have this property at all, and make it have this property at room temperature or higher. Okay, so that's the basic idea. It's the same strain game, but applied in thin film form. Of course, this is the same strain game that's going on in your computer. So one of the ways that Intel and IBM and other companies enhance the mobility of transistors is they strain them. They strain the thin film. And they boost the mobility by 25%, claims IBM for their processors. Okay. So it's just the same thing in a thin film. The way that we impose the strain on these thin crystals of oxides is that we start off with a crystal that has the same crystal structure as what we want to put down on top of it. But it has a different spacing than what we want to put down on top of it. And so as long as the film is thin, when we rain down the atoms, instead of them forming their bulk equilibrium spacing, they instead adopt the spacing of the crystal that's underneath them. Okay, this process we call epitaxy. The surface is taking its structure from the crystal that's underneath it. And there are limits to this game. Okay, so you imagine that you try to impart too much strain, that the material on top says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to form some sort of a defect. Maybe it's a crack. Maybe it's a dislocation. Or if you make the film thicker and thicker, also there becomes strain energy that's associated with that thickness. So you only can play this game when the film is very thin. Or you can have super lattices where you go back and forth and strain, and you can make it infinitely thick. But that's a finer point. So we play this game. And a key part of this game is to have a single crystal that has a different spacing than the film that you want to put down on top of it. And I'm going to talk only about perovskites. So if you don't know what a perovskite is, it's an oxide that has this crystal structure. I'm told that here in physics, you have geophysicists. So if there's any geophysicists here in the room today, perovskites, you all know that perovskites make up the majority of our planet. So if you want to know the world's most common mineral, it's perovskite. It's a very dense form. And when you get to the lower mantle, the pressures are so immense that the material wants to form like calcium silicate. It wants to form this closed packing arrangement, which is the perovskite structure. And there are zillions of perovskites, and they have all sorts of different properties and lots of different ground states that have very interesting phenomena associated with them. Okay, so let me start off first seeing the map and then imposing it on a crystal. And the work that my students and I have done over the years is all involved in crystal growth. OK, Okay, so we make, you know, thin films, we're materials people. Our inspiration comes from theorists. So up here I've put my favorite theorists that I'll show you their results in a few minutes. And then, of course, to see that we put the atoms in the right places, it's important to have some good microscopy, some synchrotron diffraction. In terms of seeing the properties, it's important to know, you know, is it ferroelectric or not? So optical techniques come in, magnetic measurements. So you'll see a lot of collaborators, and I'll show you their results. And then a very important part is the actual crystalline templates that we use as substrates to strain these materials. Okay, and a lot of what we've done has been made possible by the availability of crystals that have different spacings, and particularly spacings that we want. And our crystal, and that's come about from collaborations with these groups down here. And in fact, the group here at the very bottom, okay, is responsible for making the substrates, these nice single crystals on which we grow our films. Okay, now first let me show you the one of these predictions. And I think probably one of the reasons that we were one of the first groups to get into this in terms of straining oxides was that other people didn't know how to read the map. But this is actually a very exciting map. Okay, you might look at it and go, wow, that doesn't look like much to me. But this is what the theorists say the effect of strain should be on strontium titanate. So this is biaxial strain. So biaxial compression is on the left side to 2%. Biaxial tension is on the right-hand side to 2% over here. And strontium titanate is normally, it's on the verge of being a ferroelectric. So normally it's a boring dielectric, okay, at all temperatures, but it's on the verge. It's what people refer to as an incipient ferroelectric. It's right on the verge. It has a ground state that's close to being a ferroelectric. So if you're thinking of pushing something over the side, then strontium titanate might be a good place. And indeed, this thermodynamic analysis indicates that instead of having zero strain, where you see no Fs, Fs means ferroelectric. Okay, everywhere you see an F means ferroelectric. Okay, and it's a phase diagram, so that the polarization that you have, the spontaneous polarization, this dipole, is pointing in a different direction in each one of these different phases. Okay, but F means that when you remove the electric field, that there's a spontaneous polarization in some direction. Okay, it's ferroelectric, and you can flip that spontaneous polarization by applying an electric field. So when you see the diagram, you go, wow, not only can this material, which is normally a boring dielectric at all temperatures, be made F, but that F could exist, you know, up to room temperature, depending upon how you strain the material. Okay, so that's something that's interesting. Of course, this was, you know, theory at the time. If you don't like the picture, let me make it more visual with this diagram here. This is what's going on in the structure of the perovskite when strain is imparted upon it. So strontium titanate normally has these red things are the oxygens, and the titanium is sitting inside of this octahedron where the oxygens are at the vertex of this octahedron. Okay, so normally titanium is sitting right in the middle, and this is a centrosymmetric, and any centrosymmetric structure cannot be ferroelectric. Okay, there's no dipole. On the other hand, what the theory says is if you put it under biaxial compression, so you shrink this, it gets longer out of the plane, and now there's more room for this titanium where it can go off-center. So at zero voltage here, you can have a titanium where its rest position would be off-center. Now you can see that if you look at the center of positive charge and the center of negative charge, there's a dipole. So I have a dipole present here, and the energy is equal if this titanium was, instead of sitting upward, if it were sitting downward. So you can imagine using an electric field to flip that dipole. Okay, so this would be an example of a ferroelectric, where you have this titanium that's rattling around in here, and it's equally happy to be here or there. Biaxial tension says that polarization would be more stable in the plane. So, for example, here on the left-hand side, or equal in energy over to the right-hand side there. Okay, so this is just diagrammatically what that diagram said a minute ago, with the different Fs in the different directions. And this game that we're playing in terms of trying to access different low-energy ground states is exactly the same as what Steve does in terms of putting pressure on crystals. Okay, so he's imparting hydrostatic strain. We're imparting biaxial strain. But the idea is put on a big strain in order to change the properties and change it by a lot, okay, in terms of the ground state. So here's a more colorful view of the same diagram. Okay, you see again the Fs. This is the boring part. Okay, coming down like this at zero strain, and of course we wanted to see what is this true or is this not true? Now, this is where substrates become really important. Okay, if you're a thin film guy like me, okay, and you're thinking, okay, I want to see if this is true, if I can strain strontium titanate by, you know, several percent and make it exciting, you need to have a substrate to give it the right lattice spacing to have a 2% compression or the 2% tensile strain that you want to impart. And that's where perovskites were really lacking. So, you know, people have gone to great efforts looking all over the world for substrates, okay, until they find a nice big crystal to put these materials on. So if I go back a decade to where things stood when this prediction came out, this is what single crystal perovskite substrates were available back in 2000 when that prediction came about strontium titanate. Okay, and so if you look at them, you'll see that, okay, so on the bottom here I put what single crystals are available, and many of you in the audience I've talked to you are using these kind of single crystals, okay, to make various kinds of films. Okay, here's some typical films on top. The lattice constant of strontium titanate, of course, is perfectly lattice matched to strontium titanate, so you could grow that, but it would be pretty boring. Okay, it's not going to be strained. And the commercially available substrates a decade ago had all been developed to grow these high-temperature superconductor materials over here. So they have, you know, smaller lattice constants than strontium titanate, so you can see there are many that were developed there. And the disadvantage, okay, so this is the way the lay of the land was, but let me point out the disadvantage. These are all smaller. So in terms of being smaller, that means that it's going to correspond. So if you rain down the atoms of strontium titanate on top of a smaller substrate, the polarization that we would expect is out of plane. Okay, and if you want to be able to measure that out of plane polarization, you need to apply an electric field and switch the polarization. Okay, that means you need an electrode. You need to put an electrode on both sides of your capacitor so that you can apply an electric field. So not only do we have the problem of wanting to have a substrate that has a smaller lattice constant, we now need to be able to somehow put a conducting material below it that still has that small lattice constant. Okay, so that's an experimental difficulty of this kind of geometry. Imagine instead one had a substrate that were larger over here on the right-hand side. The advantage of having a substrate that's larger and insulating, all those substrates I showed you are insulating. Okay, there are no commercial metallic perovskite substrates. So over here on the right-hand side, imagine you had a substrate that were larger. Now the polarization should be in plane. And the advantage of that is you can make a film, and then you can apply an electric field simply by depositing interdigitated electrodes on top. And then you can apply your electric field, and it's mainly in the plane. So in terms of a synthesis, in terms of a testing whether the material is ferroelectric or not, this is much easier to test. All you need to do is rain down these atoms on top of the substrate that's larger, and then apply, and then you put the electrodes down on top. Okay, there's no bottom electrode, no epitaxial bottom electrode. There's just, you know, you put some gold on top of this thing, and then you apply a field this way, and you apply a field that way, and you see if it's ferroelectric. This one, you know, you need some magic metal that doesn't change the lattice spacing. Okay, so that's the disadvantage of all these substrates over here. And you say, okay, well, there's a substrate over here, potassium tantalate. It's about 2.5% larger. It also, if any of you have used potassium tantalate, you know that when you heat it up to growth temperatures that are typical to where you want to grow a perovskite, it loses potassium. Okay, so that's a disadvantage of that. Okay, so maybe that's why this theory didn't really go anywhere. So what my students and I did when I first went on sabbatical to Germany was we said, okay, well, we want to play the strain game with oxides, and we want to develop some new substrates that have larger lattice constants than strontium titanate, so we can do this. And the technique that we use is one that you have right here, floating zone. Okay, so the technique of it's a great method of crystal growth, particularly of new materials. Here I show its use for silicon. Okay, it's related to zone refining. So zone refining was developed at Bell Labs. It's a very important way to purify silicon. I should point out for those of you that are here, but Fan was not a PhD. He was a technician. And they were having all sorts of problems with uncontrolled dopants in silicon. And this technician came up with this way, zone refining, which is, you know, still used today in terms of purifying the material. That's now, at scale, it's used to make 8-inch wafers of silicon. So it's a very ingenious process. This material here that looks kind of white, it's so hot, it's molten. Okay, and this is solid on this side, and it's solid on that side. And it's held by surface tension between these two points. If you want to look at an ingot from today, this is float zone grown silicon. So this is silicon that has the highest purity. It's very important if you're trying to make solar cells and whatnot. And this is 8-inch diameter silicon. Okay, the same technique can be used to make oxides. You use it right here. And this is what my students and I started using in Johann Mannhardt's group at the University of Augsburg back in 2000. And the same thing is happening. This is a solid, and this is a solid, and in the middle it's molten. And this happens to be neodymium scandate. So it's this material right here, and this is where it's molten. And it's a crystal growth technique, so you rotate this crystal here, and then you slowly move the material through the hot zone. And as you move it through the hot zone, this polycrystalline material moves into the melt, it melts, and this material solidifies on this single crystal and continues a single crystal. Okay, so from a polycrystalline starting rod like this, looks like a piece of chalk, you can end up with a nice single crystal. And then seeing that we can make all of these as single crystals, and notice that the lattice constant here changes as you change the rare earth. So it gives us a way to tune what that strain is. And our collaborators at the Institute of Crystal Growth in Berlin scaled these up, and they made real crystals, as they call them, by the Tucholsky technique. And here I show a couple pictures of them. So all these rare earth scandates came about from our collaboration. More recently, we came up with this material, strontium, aluminum, gallium, tantalate. So the landscape of what substrates are there for perovskites has changed dramatically. So today, 47% of the commercially available perovskite substrates have come about by our collaboration with the Institute of Crystal Growth. And this is what allows the work that I'm going to show you. So now you can take strontium titanate and you can start to strain it in biaxial tension by applying these various substrates. And the technique that we use to do this is molecular beam epitaxy. So it's atomic spray painting, if you will. And I have, since it's a general colloquium, okay, this is what the hardware looks like. These are the people that really do the work. So I should point out that I didn't actually grow any of the films I'm going to show you here, but all the students in the group, in our extended group, grew them. And the technique itself amounts to atomic spray painting. So on the left-hand side, I have a cartoon of the process I'm talking about. Okay, it looks like atomic spray painting. On the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, the way that's realized in hardware is you have a ultra-high vacuum chamber here, so it's very, very empty, in which you have individual elemental sources of whatever it is that you want to evaporate. So say you want to make strontium titanate. So you have a strontium, you have a crucible that contains strontium, you have a crucible that contains titanium, you bring in some oxygen, and this is in this very, very empty chamber, so at those, when you heat them up in ultra-high vacuum, what evaporates doesn't collide with any other atoms. It forms a molecular beam as it makes its way from this hot source all the way, you know, across vacuum until it hits some wall or it hits the substrate, which is the middle of this chamber. So to show the process, I have a cartoon. No, let's try that again. There we go. Okay, so. This is our substrate here, but first we calibrate the sources using a quartz crystal microbalance. Okay, we see what the fluxes are of, say, titanium and strontium. Heat the substrate up to some high temperature. And then to build up this structure, which consists of alternating monolayers of strontium oxide and titanium oxide, and strontium oxide and titanium oxide, we have these shutters that open and close. Okay, so in a cartoon sense, we're building up the structure by this process called molecular beam epitaxy. Okay, and it's been used for semiconductors for over four decades and was developed at Bell Labs, but it works quite well for oxides. So we use that technique to make a thin film of strontium titanate on top of these new substrates that have larger lattice constants. And then we go and measure what the properties are and see how it compares to the theory. So let me show you our measurements. Here's a measurement of the dielectric constant as a function of temperature. Normally, strontium titanate has a dielectric constant as a function of temperature that looks like this. Okay, at room temperature, it's about 300, okay, which on this scale looks pretty small, but it's actually pretty big for a low-frequency dielectric constant. And as you cool down, the dielectric constant goes through the roof. Alex Mueller measured these years ago. It's about 20,000 at low temperature. So it's huge. Normally, when you have a ferroelectric, it has a Curie-Weiss kind of peak where it changes from being paraelectric to ferroelectric. Okay, so you have this nice peak, kind of a peak like you see here on the right in the strained strontium titanate. Okay, but in the unstrained strontium titanate, you can see it's like going up to a peak, but it never actually gets there. Okay, so you could define it as being this, you know, on the verge of being a ferroelectric transition. That's why it's easy to push over the edge. And here in the strained case of strontium titanate by putting it on top of dysprosium scandate, this peak has become real and it's moved up to temperatures that are just below room temperature. So this, you know, looks and smells like a ferroelectric transition. And indeed, if you measure the effect of a low frequency electric field on this material, the dielectric constant changes enormously at room temperature. So it's a tunable dielectric constant. It's something useful. At gigahertz frequencies, you can use a voltage and change the dielectric constant of the material by 80%. So that's, you know, it's a tunable varactor. Now, does it have anything to do with strain? The answer is yes. First of all, it agrees pretty well with theory, but let's strain it more. So here the material strained by about 1% by putting it on this rare earth scandate. Here it's strained by about 1.6% by putting it on that rare earth scandate. Notice this peak has shifted by about 100 degrees. Okay? So we've gone from something that's not ferroelectric at all to making it ferroelectric even above room temperature. And you can see the ferroelectric hysteresis loop here at room temperature. If we cool down the liquid by putting liquid nitrogen on it, we also see a hysteresis loop here. So it looks, smells, and feels like a ferroelectric, just like the theory said, okay, at room temperature. Now, if you were noticing this diagram, you might say, oh, there's some line over here that shows what would happen if you could put strontium titanate on top of silicon. So strontium titanate and silicon have totally different crystal structures. But 100 parallel to 100, the lattice mismatch is about 1.7%, okay, which is a pretty big strain. If you could make it commensurately, theory says, you know, it should be very interesting. You should be able to get this thing ferroelectric in the vicinity of room temperature. So we tried doing that. And these are some images, some TEM cross-sectional images from David Muller showing the strontium titanate on top of the silicon. And if you're here in the front row, this is a Z contrast or annular dark field image, you can see these little dumbbells in the silicon down here. And then the bright things are the high Z material, so this is the strontium and the strontium titanate. So it's atomically resolved. And you can see it's a nice sharp interface. Okay, here's a thicker film. So it looks like it has a nice sharp interface that's free of SiO2. Of course, a key question is it really strained? So we went to the synchrotron, and Joe Wojciech measured in diffraction at APS how much of the strontium titanate in the film is strained to have the same in-plane lattice constant as the underlying silicon. And that's what's represented by this part here. So this part that has the same lattice constant as the underlying silicon is going to be right at 2 in reciprocal lattice units of silicon, whereas this part of the diffraction over here is strontium titanate that's partially relaxed. And so even though in the TEM images both of these films look quite nice, what by synchrotron diffraction you can see is that as the film gets thicker, it starts to relax. So this is mainly commensurate, okay? And this film down here, which is just a few monolayers thicker, has a lot of relaxed material. And if you go from the sample that's just 5 unit cells thick to the one that's 20 unit cells thick, most of the material has become relaxed at this greater thickness. So to play the strain game, you need to strain the material. If it relaxes by introducing defects like dislocations, it's no longer going to be ferroelectric. So indeed, in this thin 5 unit cell sample, the material is ferroelectric. And Jeremy Levy, and all ferroelectrics are piezoelectric. Okay, so using an AFM tip to apply a voltage locally, Jeremy Levy was able to locally pull the ferroelectric to be either up or down. And so he wrote into this ferroelectric film of strontium titanate on silicon the crystal structure of strontium titanate on silicon. Okay, we were attempting to try to get the cover of some nice journal. Okay, we didn't get the cover, but we got this nice image anyway. So this is the it's an etch-a-sketch kind of idea. Okay, now let me move on to a material, another boring dielectric that is where theory has predicted you can make this material more interesting. And this is a material that's multiferroic, and multiferroic is one of those buzzwords that you hopefully have heard about by now. It's just about worn out, okay? But it's been, you know, in the press for the last few years. We need something new, okay? Maybe topological insulator is the new buzzword. But multiferroic is one of those buzzwords. And these are materials that have simultaneous magnetic order at the same time that they have ferroelectric order, okay? Now, what's cool about that is that there are multiple, so these are materials in which you can have multiple handles to move domains in these materials. So a ferroelectric, the handle that you have is an electric field to affect the polarization. Okay? In a ferromagnet, you move the domains by applying a magnetic field. And in a multiferroic, the interesting thing there is materials that are simultaneously magnetic and ferroelectric, where you could think of using the electric field knob to affect the magnetism, or the magnetic field knob to affect the polarization. Okay, it might seem really weird, okay, but that's the cool thing about multiferroics. Now, if I were to show you how these materials that are known today stack up in terms of their properties, here I show the ones that you might have heard about. Maybe I heard some people talking about bismuth ferrite today. This is the only room temperature multiferroic that's known today. And in terms of how it stands up, this axis shows its spontaneous polarization. So in the absence of an electric field, how big this dipole is. And this is, okay, it's huge. In fact, it's the biggest of any known ferroelectric material. Okay? It's huge. It's whopping. If you want to think about that in terms of a sheet carrier density, this is about mid 10 to the 15 electrons per square centimeter. So it's not like some, you know, wimpy 2D electron gas that's got 10 to the 11 or something. This is huge. Huge sheet carrier concentration. About half an electron per unit cell. It's a large number. Now, on the other hand, if you look at its magnetism, so how big that spontaneous magnetization is in the absence of a magnetic field, it's basically zero. This material is anti-ferromagnetic. Okay, it has some spin spiral, which gives it a very small magnetization. But it's on this axis, it's effectively zero. And the same thing is true with other ones that you might have heard about. Okay, so if I put terbium manganite on here, terbium manganite is not only anti-ferromagnetic, it's an extremely wimpy ferroelectric. Okay, and you might go, well, what are you talking about? I've seen these cool papers by Tokura. Oh, I know I'm being recorded here. Okay, so let me show you the cool papers by Tokura. This is Tokura. Tokura talking about terbium manganite. Okay, and it's really cool. It's got this great physics going on at low temperatures with a coupling between magnetization and spin phonons. But let's look at the axis of the polarization. He measures the polarization in microcoulombs per meter squared. In real ferroelectrics, we measure the polarization in microcoulombs per square centimeter. And there's four orders of magnitude difference between these numbers. Okay, so the units are in every way important. And that's why this is here, because it's extremely wimpy ferroelectric. Okay, it has some cool physics, okay, but it's extremely wimpy as a ferroelectric. The strongest known material that simultaneously, you know, not anti-ferromagnetic, but this is weakly magnetic and ferroelectric at the same time, is this nickel iron boracite, which was discovered in the 60s. Okay, and its properties also lie basically at zero. So I would say that all known multiferroics are wimpy in one way or another, and sometimes both ways. Okay, now, with that as background, this prediction from Craig Feeney, it was the end of his PhD. This is his final result from his PhD. He predicted that if you strain europium titanate, which is normally anti-ferromagnetic and paraelectric boring, okay, if you strain it, it should be here on this chart, 7 Bohr magnetons. Okay, this is europium 2+, so it's a half-filled F-shell. So this should be a whopping ferromagnet, at the same time that on this scale, as opposed to Tokura's scale, it's a real ferroelectric. Okay, it's got a polarization that's half at a barium titanate. Okay, so it's not as big as this, but it's still a big number. Now you can imagine that gets a lot of people excited. Okay, so including us. Now I should say something. This is a physics audience, so I've gotten this slide from Craig, and hopefully I don't screw it up too bad. Let me say something about what it is that's going on with the idea of strain and spin phonon coupling to make this material simultaneously ferroelectric and ferromagnetic at the same time. Okay? So europium titanate has a lot in common with strontium titanate. It's also an incipient ferroelectric. It's right on the brink of being ferroelectric. Okay? And the idea is you use strain to soften this phonon. So the way the strontium titanate was made ferroelectric by strain is you soften its phonon until the soft mode freezes out. So instead of having this mode that's doing this, it freezes out, and that titanium is off-center. Okay, and it can be off-center this way or off-center that way, but it's static. Okay, so it's frozen. Okay, so you've frozen out that soft phonon, and you do that with strain. Now, the additional term that's present in this magnetic system, europium titanate, which is just a magnetic version of strontium titanate. Okay, it's got the titanium there, and europium 2+ is like strontium 2+, except it's magnetic. Okay, it's got these 7 Bohr magnetons associated with it. And that introduces an additional term here that can influence what this phonon frequency is. So basically, you strain the material. So what he predicted was you use strain to predict, to make it so that this phonon is very, very soft, for example, on the brink of being ferroelectric. And then you can impose a magnetic field to turn ferroelectricity on in this material. And the way you do that is normally it's anti-ferromagnetic. So the spin-spin correlation function here is negative 1. So when it's anti-ferromagnetic, this adds to this frequency. It doesn't freeze it out. It stiffens it. But if you put a magnetic field on and these spins order ferromagnetically, it changes the sign of the spin-spin correlation, which then, from this number, which is small but positive, makes it negative. And it makes it become ferroelectric. So this is a way in which you could take a material, apply a magnetic field, and make it ferroelectric. Okay? That's the essence of his idea, okay? To utilize this spin-phonon coupling. Okay? So it takes the energy potential looks like this. Okay, this is a boring textbook dielectric. And you hit it with a magnetic field. You change the sign of the spin-spin correlation function, and suddenly it has a stable state here and a stable state there energetically. Okay, so you can have this, it's like the titanium. It's off-center. It's off-center this way. It's off-center that way. Okay, so in terms of pictures. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, okay, so you know why europium titanate? Well, the data for europium titanate has been there in the literature for years. So here's again measurements on bulk europium titanate, and this shows the. Let's see, what a dielectric constant. Okay, so here you can see that the dielectric constant comes up. Remember, like strontium titanate, as you go down in temperature, it comes up like this. Okay, it never goes through this full, you know, Curie-Weiss peak, right? It comes up and then it flattens off. It's an incipient ferroelectric. But then notice that something very interesting happens when europium titanate magnetically orders. So it's paramagnetic up here. It normally magnetically orders to be anti-ferromagnetic at about 5 Kelvin. And when that ordering happens, due to the spin-phonon coupling, it stiffens the lattice. So the dielectric constant comes down, okay? So it's going further away from being a ferroelectric, okay? But this shows spin-phonon coupling, this change here. And the idea of Craig is, okay, let's apply a magnetic field to this material and change the sign of this to be ferromagnetic alignment and use a magnetic field to drive ferroelectricity. So this shows the phase diagram that Craig and Karen published many years ago now. What they said was this material that at zero strain, which is way over here, is boring. It's anti-ferromagnetic and paraelectric. That if you strain it sufficiently, it'll become simultaneously ferromagnetic and ferroelectric. Or if you strain it to be just on the verge of this transition, you can then push it over the edge by applying an electric field or a magnetic field. So you can use an electric field to turn on the magnetization, or you can use a magnetic field to turn on the polarization. Okay, it sounds weird, but that's what they predicted. Okay. Now, that got a lot of people, including us, interested in this. And here's, they predicted real numbers. This is a prediction. You know, this is all before any experiment came along. Notice these numbers here. They predict real polarizations. It's in microcoulombs per square centimeter. Okay. So here's the slide that goes along with the talk. It's just like strontium titanate, except now, in addition to having the titanium go off-center, the spins become aligned. So here you see that this is ferromagnetic. Okay, this is this is my cartoon of anti-ferromagnetic. Okay, so here it's ferromagnetic. It's a G-type. This is ferromagnetic. Okay, and this is also ferromagnetic, but the polarization lies in plane. Okay, so that's the strain game. Of course, let's apply the strain game. We have these single crystals that are available. What's the lattice constant of europium titanate in bulk? Well, it happens to be identical to 4 significant figures to that of strontium titanate. It's just the magnetic version of strontium titanate. So you do the same thing, okay? Their prediction that I showed you was what happens in biaxial compression. Okay, so go back here. This is what they published, okay? They only published the biaxial compression side of it. Okay, and that's where we started to try to work on this. But again, you need to have bottom electrodes, and it's tough to do this side. So instead, we tried this, but we couldn't make... So you might look at these substrates and go, well, this is only 0.9% strain, and they say you need 1.2% strain. This is 1.5% strain, but we couldn't get a good surface on this substrate to get nice epitaxy. We go to this substrate over here, that's 3% strain, and the films crack and relax before we get to just a few unit cells in thickness. Okay, so we had a lot of trouble on this side. So instead, we thought, well, we've got all these substrates over here, and these substrates work fine for making strontium titanate ferroelectric. Craig, can you calculate what the effective strain would be for biaxial tension instead of biaxial compression? And Craig came up with this diagram. Okay, so this is what he published first in theory. We had trouble here experimentally. So then he calculated the right-hand side of this diagram. This is biaxial tension. And his prediction was that you need actually less strain to make the material simultaneously ferromagnetic and ferroelectric. And experimentally, that's, of course, a nice thing because it means that I can make the film thicker and I can have more thickness to actually make a measurement on. Okay, so, and here I've put the substrates on. So this is zero strain. So always important to have a control sample. Can't emphasize that enough. Okay, and here we're going to show you results that are 0.9% in biaxial compression and 1.1% in biaxial tension by straining it. And we'll come back to see how that compares to Craig's prediction. Okay, now I mentioned that, you know, they made this prediction back in 2006, and you can imagine every thin film person jumped on this, wanted to make the world's studliest. This would be the world's studliest multiferroic. So the coefficients that I'm showing you are 1,000 times, or each coefficient itself is 100 times stronger than any known material. Okay, so you have both these together, it should be really good. Now, MBE, I have to tell you, is extremely slow. So not only is it slow in deposition, but it takes a long time to do anything. And so we were not the first people to make this stuff, nor were we the first people to publish it. In fact, we were the fourth people to publish it. Okay, but let me show you what the first three people got when they did this, at least the first three that published. And those results are shown here. Now, this is growing europium titanate on top of strontium titanate. So this is nominally the unstrained case, what I'll call a control sample. And what's seen in diffraction, this is my colleague Joel Brock and Yuri Suzuki at Cornell, what's seen in diffraction is the intense peak here is the substrate peak. So this is the strontium titanate peak. And then the film peak are these broader peaks over here. You see some thickness fringes. But this peak over here on the side, this is the main film peak. And you can see it's not directly on top of the substrate peak, which seems kind of weird. Because if it's unstrained, these peaks should be, the lattice spacing should be exactly the same. And that same thing is true also in this result over here. The film peak you can definitely see is different from the substrate peak. Okay, even though it's europium titanate and strontium titanate. Here's another group. These are three different groups. Okay, this group, this is the film peak, and this is the substrate peak. These are all STL. Okay, so strontium titanate. And so what's seen by all three of these groups, and they use a different technique to grow the films than we do. Okay, so this is my opportunity to say bad things about the competition. So this technique that they use is really fast, okay? And I've been burned many times in the past by this technique. So in trying to make superconductors or something, some new superconductor would come along when I was a grad student and we tried to make it by MBE, and this technique, which is pulse laser deposition, they'd have it in a week, they'd have it superconducting and everything, and we'd still be working on it for a year, with no results. In this case, this compound is so sensitive that it really depends on how you deposit it, okay? And to make that clear, let me show you the magnetic results that came out from two of those three studies. Okay, the first study by Joel Brock, this was before Craig Feeney's prediction. Okay, so they were studying it from a crystal growth perspective. They were making this on the synchrotron, and they wanted some really boring material that they could put on top of strontium titanate and just study the crystal growth. So they wanted something that was perfectly lattice matched, okay, and that's why they were doing this. Now, these studies were influenced by the prediction of Feeney and Rabe, so they measured the magnetic properties, and what they found was magnetic properties look like this. This is their film, okay, and this is what bulk europium titanate looks like blown up 10 times. So bulk europium titanate is anti-ferromagnetic at about 5 Kelvin, okay, blown up 10 times. Their film is ferromagnetic, okay? Here's the results of this other group. This group, it doesn't matter what they put the europium titanate down. They can put it down, on what should be unstrained or strained in different directions. No matter what they put it down on, it's ferromagnetic. Okay, so that could be really useful. If you're trying to make a material that's ferromagnetic, this could be great. You just put it on anything, and suddenly it's ferromagnetic. But if you want to see if theory is right, and you're accessing different ground states by strain, you need a technique that can at least see the unstrained properties, and then you can evaluate what the effect of strain is. And this is what I'm talking about is true not only in europium titanate, it also is true in many perovskite systems. Here, just to continue my bashing, this is what you get when you grow strontium titanate on strontium titanate. It might seem like the world's most boring thing to do by a thin film technique. You grow A on A, okay? Well, what should you get? You should get A. You should see nothing. You should see the same thing as the single crystal. It should just continue it. But when you do this by pulse laser deposition, this has been seen by many groups for many years. This is the substrate peak of strontium titanate, and this is the film peak. And depending on the pressure that you deposit it at, this film peak becomes, you know, further and further away from where it should be. So there's some weird, you know, expansion going on. This is another group that's done the same thing. They change the fluence all over the place, okay? And they see that this is the substrate peak. This is K-alpha-1, K-alpha-2 splitting from the strontium titanate single crystal. This is the film. It's moving all over the place, okay? Homoepitaxy, you know, growing A on A. You know, what's going on? There's some sort of defects going on there, okay? This is my favorite. This group, they grew strontium titanate on strontium titanate. So this, again, should be unstrained, and yet it's ferroelectric. Okay, so awesome. If you can, these things that have ground states that are very close are really sensitive. Okay, so they can be very sensitive to defects. And if you have a technique that, like pulse laser deposition, things are a little bit more energetic when they're coming in. Okay, and you can get defects. MB is a thermal evaporation. All the species coming in are neutral. The energies involved are less than 1 eV. It's a very, you know, just KT, very nice technique. So we wanted to see, you know, how does our technique stand up? So we rain down europium titanate on top of strontium titanate, and okay, we use these growth conditions, whatever. Now what we see is really boring in terms of X-ray diffraction. So X-ray diffraction, the film peak is right on top of the substrate peak. If we zoom in, here's a zoomed in here. We zoom in, the substrate peak's this big sharp thing. The film peak's right on top of it. You see thickness fringes because the film has a different electron density than the substrate that it's on top of. But they're on top of each other. And if you look at the magnetic properties, it's anti-ferromagnetic like it should be. So it's a gentle technique, and now we can evaluate the effect of strain. So we strain it by putting it, for example, on a smaller substrate, or in this case it's LSAT. Put it on a smaller substrate, and what we see is now on a smaller substrate, where we've squeezed it, it gets longer out of plane. That shifts this peak to the left in diffraction. Okay, and it's the amount that you expect. You calculate this from elastic stiffness. The rocking curves are really nice. Okay, again, the film peak is separate from the substrate peak. Do the same thing on dysprosium scandate, so we strain it in the opposite direction. Pull it this way, it gets shorter that way, shifts the peaks the opposite direction. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Enough structural characterization. It does what you think it should. Looks good. Do we have the right oxidation states in the film? So we check this, you know, europium, if you're a chemist, can be 2+ or 3+. We want just the 2+. We don't want it to be too oxidized. So we did X-ray absorption spectroscopy, or our collaborators, John Freeland, did X-ray absorption spectroscopy, and David Muller at Cornell did EELs to measure the oxidation state of the europium and the titanium. It's a cross-section. So this is like a typical Z contrast. But then here with atomic resolution EELs mapping, he's mapped where the europium 2+ is, where the dysprosium 3+ is. So this is the substrate, dysprosium scandate. You can see it's a nice sharp interface with the right oxidation states, not a lot of interdiffusion. So it looks like what we want. How do its properties look? Okay. So we have the control sample. The control sample, for example, europium titanate and strontium titanate. When we use a technique like second harmonic generation that is sensitive to centers of inversion. So if your material is centrosymmetric, it does not show SHG. So this, no SHG is seen here. SHG is seen in the europium titanate on dysprosium scandate. Okay, and that's seen at a temperature that's, you know, very close to what you get when you strain strontium titanate. So this looks like, and SHG is sufficient but insufficient proof of ferroelectricity. So this shows that it does not have it lacks a center of symmetry. So it could be ferroelectric. And then by putting electrodes on it and moving the domains around, it's possible to optically follow this hysteresis loop. This is all done by Venkat Gopalan's group at Penn State. You could do a polar plot. So Venkat's done a polar plot, can figure out what the point group is. It's MM2, it's a polar point group. It matches exactly what first principles theory says it should be. So, yes, it is ferroelectric, and it's in fact ferroelectric in the vicinity of room temperature, about 270 Kelvin here. Is it ferromagnetic? These are measurements by Zeke Johnston Halperin's group at Ohio State. Here's the same sample that I just showed you from the SHG, europium titanate on dysprosium scandate. Nice ferroelectric hysteresis loop. Again, the control samples, okay, the opposite strain state, even a bare substrate. It's always important to do control samples, nothing. So it's ferromagnetic and ferroelectric at the same time. How about the magnitude of the magnetization? This is a squid measurement. The squid measurement was tricky to do because the substrate itself, dysprosium scandate, has a big paramagnetic background, and it's very thick. So when you typically apply a magnetic field, like to see if the thing is ferromagnetic, you get a huge response from the substrate. So, and furthermore, the substrate itself goes through an anti-ferromagnetic transition temperature here, which we didn't know about before, but in making these measurements, we figured out, oh, the substrate's got a transition of its own. Okay, so here on the same sample, this is the Mohs magneto-optic Kerr effect, and this is the squid measurement, and you see the squid shows this kink. The advantage of squid over Mohs is the Mohs, we don't know how much magnetization is there. Whereas in the squid measurement, once we figure out what's going on, we can see, oh, it's Bohr magnetons. It's a huge magnetization. Here's just what the bare substrate looks like. So here's a bare dysprosium scandate substrate. Here's a substrate that has a film on top of it. So this place, this where it turns on here at 4.4 Kelvin, this is the ferromagnetic transition of the europium titanate. So to wrap things up and compare to what was predicted versus what we see, indeed, we see that when we strain it by this amount, it becomes ferromagnetic and ferroelectric at the same time. It's the world's studliest multiferroic, 1,000 times stronger than anything that's been found before, but at 4 Kelvin. Okay. Now, if we come back to this diagram of Craig's that I've shown you, we've verified this idea, but in terms of verifying that you can turn on ferromagnetism by applying an electric field when the material is on the brink, what we have lacked to do that is a substrate that strains it at just the right place. Okay, and on the compressive side, there is a substrate. So LSAT, which we've grown it on, does have this. And so just this week in Nature Communications, we have a paper showing that you can influence this magnetic transition by applying a magnetic field to the material. You can influence the electric polarization. But we wanted to do this over here on this side. And to do that, together with our collaborators in Germany, we developed a new substrate that has exactly the lattice constant that's right in the middle of this region. Okay, so this is our newest perovskite substrate. The story's not finished, so I'm gonna end just on this note of we would like to we've been putting europium titanate films on top of this, and what we would like to do is to see that by applying an electric field to this insulator, we can turn on 7 Bohr magnetons of magnetization. So if I'm to conclude, we've seen these results for europium titanate, and perhaps the most exciting ones are yet to come. Let me thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.